Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Silicon Valley Forum of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from Hyatt Ricky's Palo Alto. I am Denise Carter, president of Carter McNulty, and chair of the Silicon Valley Forum Business Council, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome the listeners of WSUI in Iowa City, Iowa, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on the radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealth.org. And now for today's speaker. Patricia Ireland is the president of the largest, most visible, and most successful feminist organization in the United States, the National Organization for Women, with 500,000 contributing members and 550 chapters. Miss Ireland is also the author of the new book, What Women Want. In her book, she speaks frankly about her own journey to empowerment, both political and personal. From being a teenage bride and a flight attendant for Pan Am Airlines to becoming a successful corporate lawyer and the leader of the nation's largest organization for women's rights. An articulate, inspirational, and brave warrior in the tradition of Susan B. Anthony, Miss Ireland reminds us of what has been won and what must still be done. Please welcome Patricia Ireland.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here with you all tonight. I love this part of the country and this part of the state, so I'm particularly glad to be here with you. And I just finished an 18-campus speaking tour, so I'm also glad to be with the grown-ups. I had a grand time on the campuses, but it always makes me feel a little old. I also want to thank you for getting me out of Washington. I really appreciate that more than you know. Every time I think that we're going to be finished with this Clinton saga, something else happens. You know, one of the two women who, the only two who've been prosecuted out of this whole four-year Starr investigation is Julie Hyatt Steele. She was just tried in Virginia a couple of weeks ago on charges of obstruction of justice because she told Michael Isikoff of Newsweek that she had learned from Kathleen Willey almost the day that it happened, that Willey had told her the story that she then told on 60 Minutes ultimately. So she didn't tell that under oath. She told that to a reporter. And every time she's been under oath, she has said that she didn't learn of it until later. And that the reason she had said initially to the reporter that she had learned of it right away was because her good friend Julie called her up and said, you know, I'm in a little trouble here. You got to give me a hand. I just want you to tell this reporter that I told you at the time. So, you know, it's back in the news again. There's a hung jury there, and they're trying to decide if she's going to be retried. And then I go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I walk in, and who do I run into but Susan McDougal? I mean, they're just like, get me out of here. And at the same time, this has not been all bad. I know that's, you know, it's sort of hard sometimes to find the pony amid all the droppings. But, I mean, for one thing, we got to hear Henry Hyde talk about a five-year affair with a married woman when he was in his 40s and call it a youthful indiscretion. Now, if that's youthful, I'm just hitting my prime here. You know, I'm really starting to peak. This is a good thing. I guess you have to go all the way to 96-year-old Strom Thurmond before you get to old. I mean, Strom really is from another era, and I think it must have been very difficult for him to sit through all of this discussion about SEX, and some pretty explicit discussion at that. Who ever would have thought we'd hear Katie Couric talking about oral sex? Oh! But despite the fact that it may make them uncomfortable, it's very clear that we do need some sex education in Congress. And so when they come home for their district meetings, I want you to go and I'll tell them where babies come from, because on both sides of the aisle, they think babies come from welfare checks. And it's, but I mean, what can you expect in a culture where the Surgeon General of the United States, remember Joycelyn Elders, gets fired for telling the truth that people masturbate? And in answer to a question at an AIDS conference, acknowledged not only that people do gratify themselves, but also that it might be a good form of safe sex in this era of STDs and HIVs. And for her candor, she was fired by Bill Clinton. Don't you know he wishes he had listened to her? Well, I was sort of chagrined when I got the letter from your esteemed chair saying that one of the things you might like to hear about is feminists' take on the Clinton debacle. And I was like, oh, no. But on the other hand, I did start thinking about it. And besides deciding that, you know, it was worth something just to hear Henry Hyde's little story, and thinking about Monica Lewinsky, whose indiscretion was actually youthful, I started thinking about what the positives might be. You know, I'm in this movement for social change because I believe that individuals and cultures can be changed and do change, and because I'm an optimist. And, you know, it's what keeps me an optimist is being an activist. It keeps me from slipping down when something bad happens and just pulling the covers up over my head. But I thought of a couple of things, and I guess one of them is to recognize that this provides us, I think, with a really good opportunity to change the laws and the lawmakers to the good. If I look at the progress that we've made and where we have to go, I would say that the vision of Cheryl Mills, who is one of the White House counsels and was on the floor of the United States Senate, arguing the case against impeachment. And I looked at this young African-American woman lawyer, and I thought, that is a measure of how far we've come. And then the camera shifted, and I looked at the United States Senate. And it's 91% white, no African-Americans. And it's 91% men. And I thought that really is a measure of how far we have to go. A lot of those men are really good men. I work with a lot of them and I have over years. They carry bills that we care about. Chuck Schumer pushes the Violence Against Women Act. And, you know, there's some really good men there. And they have a different experience in life. Women, you may have noticed, you know, there are some differences, viva la, et cetera. But, you know, we are still the primary caregivers of the very young and the very old. We are the ones who get pregnant. You may have noticed that. We're the ones who often face every crime that you men fear, and on top of that, the violence in our own homes. And so I think we do bring a different perspective to the table of public policy. I think of my own Congress member from Florida, Carrie Meek, who I was very proud to campaign for in 1992 when she moved from the Florida House to the House of Representatives of the United States. And I think of Carrie because her grandparents were slaves. And I think it's really easy for those of us who have white skin to forget how recently and how devastating an experience slavery was in this country. So Carrie's grandparents were slaves. Her parents were sharecroppers. They worked somebody else's land so that they could feed their family. And Carrie and her sister have both worked as so-called domestics. They cleaned somebody else's house so they could have a home. And now Carrie Meek is in the U.S. Congress. Don't you know she has a different response when somebody comes after cutting the funds for public education or public health or any of the anti-discrimination laws? She's strongly pro-choice. And those are the odds when we get women into elected office. And we're playing the odds when we say, you know, look at the Congress, it's 91% guys. Dick Armey looks at the Congress as a whole, which is like 89% guys, and pronounces it too femme-centric. I mean, it's a wonderful word, femme-centric. I'm not sure it applies to a group that's still 89% guys, but, you know. But we're playing the odds, and I'm doing it because I want the issues to move. And so in a dark room, I would choose 50-50, women and men. And on the other hand, you give me an individual race, and I'm going to look who's better on my issues. And it did not escape me that after 1992 and the so-called year of the woman, like we would be happy with 1 year and one woman, the right wing took a page from our book. And in 1994, they ran a whole lot of very conservative women. It was the Linda Smiths of the world who fortunately then took on Patty Murray. Yes, and is gone. But, you know, some very conservative women. And so I think it's important to remember that this is for the issues. This is because a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds have something to add to the mix when we talk about public policy. The laws are going to apply to all of us, and it seems to me that, you know, all of us ought to be at the table in some ways. Well, I think that this is a good time to make some of those changes because there has been such an increasing disconnect between people in their communities and in their families and what's going on in Washington, D.C., and I know from all the polls that voters trust women candidates more. And, you know, that may be, as some would argue, because women are just, you know, more honest, and as others would rather cynically argue that we just haven't been close enough to the real power and money to get involved in a big scandal that everybody would know about. We'll wait and see how it turns out. But the voters do trust women candidates more. And I think this is a very important opportunity in the year 2000 to fill up that pipeline again, to get the Carrie Meeks into the state assembly or into the local school board so that they're poised and ready to move up and keep pushing. I mean, we've got so few women in governor's mansions and in the United States Senate. We've got 3 governors, women governors. We've got 9 women senators. If we're ever going to get a woman in the White House who gets there by election instead of marriage, you know, traditionally they come from the governor's mansions and the Senate in recent years. We got to have more of us there. I want better choices. I do not want to go to the poll and have to choose between the evil of two lessers. And that brings me back to the Clinton scandal. I think that one of the other lessons about this is that even flawed people can do good things. And some people who do good things are not going to be 100% with you. This is a man who did a great deal to move family and medical leave, to move the Violence Against Women Act, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, to increase the earned income tax credit, which has not gotten a lot of visibility but has a really positive impact on the working poor, and most of the poor are employed. So he's appointed more women and people of color than any previous administration, blah, blah, blah. And he reflects something that is not just limited to Clinton, it's in our culture. And really, in some ways, it's been there since the Garden of Eden. If you take that tale and say, well, you know, since the Garden of Eden, men in sexual matters, men have been dominant and women have taken the blame. And so the issue of getting more of us in power, I think, is going to be a very important part of this. The whole piece of what we've been through as a country in this last 18 months or 2 years, I think should raise our awareness that we don't have very good choices at the top of the ticket. I mean, I think that's why I have little dents on the side of my nose is from voting. Well, like that, you know? And on the other hand, I am someone who believes in voting. I believe in participating in the political process. I believe that that is a way to make change. I'm working also to change public opinion and to change the culture that reflects in Bill Clinton's kind of dividing the world between Madonnas and whores. They're women you have to respect, like Donna Shalala, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Janet Reno, Madeleine Albright. And then there are these other women that you can use like tissue paper and throw away. And I think that is a cultural problem that we see. And I also know from seeing not just that division of women, I mean, in my high school it was the good girls and the bad girls, and you could tell the bad girls because they smoked. Do you remember that? Yeah. And now I look and I go, yeah, they were bad smoking, and I started smoking. You know, it was a terrible thing. But it's the second piece of that is that when women bring forward charges of sexual harassment or rape, it is almost always still, to this day, after all this work that we've done, brought back on them. They either made it up or they wanted it. They're either nuts or sluts. And it's the common defense. When I was in law school, in criminal law, I was taught that the perfect rape survivor, from the prosecutor's point of view, is a woman who is old enough to tell her story, but not old enough to ever have had a smoke, a drink, or a date. Basically, any adult behavior can be turned and used against you, again, in that split of you're a good girl or you're not. And again, I think that we can often use these disasters in our country's history or in our country's current events to try to put a public spotlight on some of these remaining stumbling blocks for women moving into positions of power, for women having a shot at being a neurosurgeon or a welder, working construction, or being a full-time homemaker and having their work respected and not having this sexualized context out there that really, really holds us back. And I think that is something that we can also take out of this last year and a half or 2 years. And that is that in addition to changing the laws, we have got to change, changing the lawmakers, we've got to change some of the laws. I have lived for the last umpteen years with conservative commentators. The most recent was Bob Novak on one of these television shows saying to me, the sexual harassment laws have gone too far. They've gone so far that you can't even pat your colleague on the shoulder and tell her she did a good job without getting sued for harassment. Well, now let's look at that. Paula Jones brought forward her charges, and she had picked a forum, and she had gone down to the Federal District Court in Arkansas and told her story. And Judge Susan Weber Wright, on a motion from the plaintiffs, from the Clinton side, basically looked at her complaint and said, even if you can prove everything in your complaint, you don't have a right to go to trial. That is not a violation of the harassment or civil rights laws in that case. That means that that judge was saying you can run your hand up the inside of a woman's thigh, expose yourself to her, ask her for oral sex, and on the way out the door, remind her that you're personal friends with her immediate supervisor, and that's not harassment. That's a one-time event. And that's what has come to be called the one free feel rule. And it is, I wish I could tell you that Judge Susan Weber Wright was out of, you know, way out of the mainstream in that interpretation, but she's not. The sexual harassment law is a relatively recent evolution, and it's still an evolving law. And right now, it's not clear what between a hostile environment and quid pro quo. I mean, he didn't say put up or get out of the job, so it wasn't the, you know, the quid pro quo. And was a one-time event enough to create a hostile environment where you couldn't do your work? I mean, what sexual harassment does is, especially if it's intermittent and in a hostile environment, You never know when you're coming to work whether this is going to be a day where you're going to be really tensed up because there's going to be more harassment and ugly words and touching, and or whether you're going to be able to do your work that day. And you start getting these stress-related illnesses, edging over toward post-traumatic stress syndrome, except the trauma is still going on. And so you have increased absenteeism. You have stress-related illnesses. You have a problem focusing on your job because you're looking over your shoulder. You're kind of twitching about what's going to happen. Well, does a one-time event do that? I have to think that if there is a sexual touching, if, for instance, Kathleen Willey had brought charges, and if what she said is true, that Clinton put his hands on her breast, put her hands on his erection, and she was there looking for a job, according to Susan Weber Wright and that interpretation, that is not sexual harassment. Well, let's call it something else then, but let's make it illegal, because it is not, you know, I don't know why any woman and any of us who have faced harassment in our work lives, I think we're just horrified. Why should a woman have to put up with that? I mean, why? Well, part of the reason is because I think some men are just uncomfortable with women moving into the workforce and into previously all-male bastions, whether it's the soapbox derby or the United States Supreme Court or something in between. And so when they're uncomfortable, they try to put the situation, I mean, even good change makes people uncomfortable. So they try to put it back into a context in which they are comfortable, a sexualized context. And again, going back to that kind of Garden of Eden thing, you know, that's where they kind of feel comfortable dealing with women. And there's also, I think, some men, not many, but some enough to be a serious problem, really don't want to compete with women on an equal playing field on the merits. It must have been a lot easier if you wanted to be a lawyer or an astronaut and you could wipe out half the population and say, I never have to compete with them, they're girls. And so you go on the auto assembly line in a town ironically called Normal, Illinois, where the Mitsubishi plant is, and you find these guys who have got some of the best jobs in that town. They've got good benefits, they're union jobs, you've got good pay, and the women want the jobs for the same reason, and some of those guys feel like they don't want that competition. I don't know how many of them it's conscious, but I know it's there. I mean, the harassment and the physical assaults and all, it's just, it's to me, it seems designed to say to a woman, you will never be my equal. I will never be your peer. You'll always be a set of body parts to me, honey. And I think back to Jerry Ferraro being named to the ticket with Fritz Mondale in 1984. It was the first and only time I've ever been to the Democratic National Convention. And over there at the Moscone Center, I heard Jerry Ferraro give her acceptance speech, and I was so excited, because when I was in law school and somebody would say to me, what do you want to be when you get out of law school, I would always say a Supreme Court justice. I have no interest in a career on the bench. I do not have a judicial temperament. And yet I liked watching their eyes roll around in their heads, because at that time there had never been a woman on the Supreme Court. There had never been a woman attorney general. And so to me, the top of my profession looked pretty darn closed. And it meant that all the guys who wanted to go to the top, you know, got to knock me out on the way. And so when I heard her accepting that speech, I was so taken with it. And the next day I came back and I was just crushed, because there were so-called jokes going around, like what'll happen if Mondale's elected? We'll have three boobs in the White House. A cab driver told me that and then glared at me in the mirror and said, ah, you feminists just don't have any sense of humor, because I didn't laugh. And I guess I just wanted to prove him wrong, so I told him every anti-male joke I had ever heard on the way to the Moscone Center. I mean, all of them, you know, like if you throw a man and a bowling ball off the Empire State Building, which hits the ground first? Who cares? No, I mean, they're politically incorrect. You're not supposed to say things or think things like that. It gives you a bad image. It's a stereotype thing. But I told him every one of those jokes. It seemed like the thing to do. And he never laughed at one of them. I don't think taxi drivers have a sense of humor. But it was, to me, that same idea that when a woman was getting to a place where women had never been before, there was an urge to reduce her to her body parts. She had been the nominee for less than 24 hours, and already they were putting out buttons that said Fritz and Tits. And I think that, you know, we still would like to think, okay, that's 84. But you still come up to the current day, and it's still a way to keep women out of the higher-paying jobs, the best positions, the academic medicine, the dean of the school, the idea that when you try to move into a position of power, there's going to be an overwhelming interest in your personal life and in your sexual life, and if you've got kids or whether you're planning to have kids. I mean, after 1992, everybody was sworn in, and Clinton came forward to do his appointment of the first ever woman attorney general. You may remember the sequence. The first one was Zoe Baird. And both sides of the aisle on the Senate Judiciary Committee, one of my faves, started saying to her, well, you say you go to work about 8 o'clock and you don't come home until 8 o'clock. When do you see your son? Who does take care of your house? And I was like talking back to the television, as I often do, saying, well, if that was Joey Baird instead of Zoe Baird, they never would have even asked the question. But because they asked the question and it came out that she had hired undocumented household workers, she was out of there. The next one was Kimball Wood. She was coming and gone so fast that most people didn't even notice it. She didn't get a hearing because it turned out she had hired undocumented workers in her household. Now, mind you, when Kimba hired those workers, it was not illegal to hire undocumented workers. So I figured, okay, she must have been supposed to use her women's intuition to understand they were going to pass the law and comply in advance. I mean, it was all like a thing. But she was out of there. And sure enough, it came to us about that time that indeed I was right about Joey Baird, because it turned out there were two men in the cabinet already confirmed who also had the nanny gate problem. But they, of course, laid it off on their wives, because we all know it's the women who are responsible for the household help and the children. So I started going around Washington saying, you know, if Clinton is going to keep his promise to name the first ever woman attorney general, it's going to have to be a childless woman with a dirty house. And along came Janet Reno. A childless woman and a self-confessed bad housekeeper. But no sooner had the Washington wags breathed a sigh of relief that she didn't have the nanny gate problem than the tongue started wagging again. Oh, a woman in her 50s, never been married, must be queer. Happened just about that fast that the discussion moved from, was she tough enough, was she a good enough politician, did she know the law, was she strong enough, to who does she love? Who does she sleep with? And again, I think that is a phenomenon that is peculiar to women's ascent in our society, that suddenly everybody's very interested in your personal life and in your sexuality and in your family and has to kind of dig around in there. I know I sat down in Los Angeles at a national conference of NOW, the year that Patty Murray was running and Josie Heath was in Colorado running, and Dianne Feinstein and I think Boxer was there, and we had to make sure that we had a Republican representative. We had Barbara Hafer from Pennsylvania, who's a statewide officer there. And to a woman, they were married, divorced, single, and you know, with kids and without kids. And to a woman, at some point in their campaign, someone had said that they were a lesbian. And so we started telling all of our candidates and all of our activists, look, it is not a question of whether, but when somebody's going to throw that to you. And you better figure out what you're going to say in advance. And there's lots of good answers. I mean, one of them is yes. But I like, best of all, Gloria Steinem's answer. Years ago, when a reporter asked her if she were a lesbian, she looked at him and she said, "Are you the alternative?" And I thought it was like, you know, and until it is no more important than a joke, it's going to keep, you know, it's going to still be in our way. I mean, right now, if you are deemed to be a lesbian, whether it's true or not, you can lose your job, your credit, your housing. You can lose custody of your kids. You can lose your life. And so that is, again, I think, using women's personal lives and sexuality as a way to keep us in our place. And I'm not paranoid, but we do have real enemies out there. I was not surprised because I think a lot of people, I mean, the good news is that we have changed the culture tremendously. We've made tremendous progress just in my adult lifetime. I mean, when I was a stewardess for Pan Am, we didn't even have the words sexual harassment, much less a remedy for it. And yet their ad campaigns were like, "We really move our tails for you." And Nationals, "I'm Cheryl, fly me." To which some of my colleagues responded by making buttons that said, "Fly yourself." But we couldn't even name the acts that that ad campaign produced. And so, you know, I look at that and I know that we're starting to move in the right direction and that we're getting it. But we're not there yet. Progress is not equality. And progress is also not inevitable. It didn't happen because there was, a few good men elected to the Senate or in the House or on the court. It happened because we had strong movements that demanded change. And I always think back to Frederick Douglass, who was a tremendous, wonderful speechmaker. He learned to read by reading a book of great oratory. And one of his speeches ends with the line that I'm sure many of you have heard, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will." And so I'm hoping that on those 18 campuses where I went and in this room tonight, that many of you will help continue to make that demand for equality and for justice and for fairness. It is a benefit not only to women but to our families, to our communities. If women have equal education and equal employment, our families are more secure economically. If women have the ability to plan and space our children, we have lower infant mortality and women ourselves are healthier. If we can rid our homes of family violence, we will be safer, but we'll also break that cycle of violence that produces more violent people, people who think you solve problems that way, or that that's the only way to live in the world because, you know, you're either the beat-or or the beatee. If we have women who, with all of the options available to us, willingly, even joyfully, choose to be wives and mothers, our families are really blessed with our love, and it holds our family together. And so I do see everything we're doing as family values. I know Dan Quayle was just here again doing his routine, and I was thinking how odd it was that he keeps confusing fictional characters with reality. But, I mean, to me, those are real family values. And I really hope that we can keep this movement going. We're in a different place now. We've got lots of us on the inside of various powerful institutions that shape our society: law, medicine, the arts, humanities, journalism, fundraising, public relations, all of these, religion, all these places where we've got women and men who believe in equality between women and men in these positions, and they're changing institutions from the inside. Maybe the activism doesn't look the same in the year 2000 as it did in 1966 when NOW was formed, but I believe we have a greater opportunity to make change because we can do that inside-outside strategy. We do get the calls from the transition team in Arkansas saying, "Look, the women are not making the short lists. And if you want to get more women in the cabinet, you better turn up the heat." And so we turn up the heat. And Bill Clinton goes out there and nominates Hazel O'Leary for energy. Now, of course, he's out there. He's got to take a little swipe at us. He's got to say we're bean counters and quota queens. Great. You know? I mean, I'm going to tell you just one more thing because I want to make sure that we have time for questions. But I also want to remind those of us here who went through the fight over 209 and were told that there was no longer any discrimination. Do you see any discrimination? I don't see any discrimination. And so I made this little list. And of course, one of my favorite groups out here was Angry White Guys for Affirmative Action. You know, they... You know, 64% of our families now depend on the income of women. The two income, the two earner families, who often have the kids in the workforce as well to keep their family income high enough to afford college, which makes a big difference in whether you survive economically these days. I want you to know that it's not mean-spirited when I say that white men are 40% of the population. And yet they hold 75% of the Supreme Court clerkships, more than 80% of the tenured professors, 84% of the partners in major law firms, 87% of the school superintendents, 89% of the senators, 96% of the CEOs in the major corporations in this country, 99% of the owners of professional sports teams, and 100% of our presidents. No wonder they're angry. So I really hope that you will, each of you, think about one thing that you could do, one step that you could take outside of your comfort zone. Take a little risk. It's how you grow. And keep a straight face the next time somebody tells something like, you know, what'll happen if we have three boobs in the White House. And look them in the rearview mirror in the eye and say, maybe you could explain that. I don't think that's funny. You know, talk back, speak up, tell the truth about your lives, write letters to the editor, call in those right-wing radio talk shows, tell them what you think. You know, you'll have to keep moving because they'll only let you on once unless you keep using different names, which could also be fun. But you don't have to do what I've done. I have devoted every waking hour of my life since about 1975 to this movement, and I love it. But I think sometimes it scares people. They think if they get close, they'll get caught in the ringer. And, you know, here's the story. I just want a little bit of your time. I just want a little bit of your money. That's like I've been leading myself, and I know that Helen Grieco, who's the state coordinator, state president of California now, we were just talking about that on the way. We have each been leading ourselves on that way. There's just a little more to do. After the election, things will settle down. After Women's History Month, I'll take a break. After I speak to the Commonwealth Club, I'll fly down to Los Angeles and speak at UCLA tomorrow morning, which is my way of telling you that I will have to run after, you know, I probably have to be out the door by about 9 o'clock. And I so enjoy being here with you that I'd like to go to questions and answers because I know what I think. I'd like to hear a little bit from you.
Thank you, Patricia Ireland, President of the National Organization for Women, for your talk here tonight. It is now time for our question and answer session. Here to ask the questions is Dr. Colleen Wilcox, Superintendent of Schools for the County of Santa Clara and President of the California Organization for Superintendents.
We have a very large number of questions from our audience. So I'm just going to begin and get started. I've tried to delineate them into various categories. And the first one has to do with the organization itself. And there are a number of questions regarding the organization. And let me begin by asking, your organization has a large membership base of 500,000 members. How does NOW recruit? And how is the recruitment going now?
our trajectory from 1966 to date, if you drew the line, would be constantly up. But there are waves in between. And those waves represent bad times in politics or bad things that happen in the country. Anita Hill gives her testimony in November 1991. And our membership starts coming in at about 3 to 5 times the normal rate. Bill Clinton is elected, And many people breathe a sigh of relief and go, whew, he's pro-choice. Da-da-da-da. They go back to their lives. And our membership recruitment starts falling. 94, Gingrich is elected. Yes, we prosper in adversity. He says stupid things. People call us and want to join. You know, it's like that kind of thing. And this year, with all of the obsession and maniacal obsession with Bill Clinton and his sex life, our membership has started going up again. And I don't, you know, I think it was partly the people who were watching those who were doing the prosecution and seeing, hi, okay, Henry Hyde, you had a youthful indiscretion. Okay, Bob Barr, which defense of marriage, you know, which marriage are you defending, your first, second, or third? Okay, you know, Livingston, oh, you got to go. You know, I mean, so we do our recruitment, and we prosper most when people are aware that there still is a lot of work to do, that we haven't achieved at all. And we recruit principally through the mail. When we started that, we were one of the few groups who did direct mail, and people actually read it and thought it had valuable information. I used to save it and use it for my speeches. You know, there were facts in there and lines that I could use. And now, of course, it's junk mail, and we spend a lot of time talking about how to put what to put as a teaser on the envelope to make people open it. So we're also moving toward paid advertising, television, print ads. We're going to go up with that in the first quarter of the year 2000 to start the century off right.
Thank you, Patricia. The administration and Congress have given us welfare reform. What is NOW's position on that landmark legislation?
It's one of the reasons I get so irritated with all of the talk show hosts who start out by saying, well, you've been defending Clinton. You know, you don't want to take him on because, you know, he's been pro-choice. We really strongly opposed that bill in Congress, the one that finally was passed and signed. It had a lot, it was based in a lot of ways on stereotypes of who the poor are. And I used to think back to when my mother would tell me as I was growing up, be a teacher because you'll be home after school. When your kids are there, you'll have the summers off and you'll have something to fall back on. If your husband dies or leaves you. And it was very clear it would be better if he died. I wasn't sure why until we went through this welfare deform. And I realized that if he left me and I fell into poverty, or if I was in a violent relationship and I left him and fell into poverty, I was a dirty welfare cheat. If he died, I was a respectable widow, entitled to Social Security benefits. So I thought the bill was, literally cut off people who have experienced tremendous violence. Long-term welfare recipients or public assistance recipients have somewhere up around 90% having experienced serious traumatic violence in their lives. They have all the things that go with post-traumatic stress. They have hypervigilance, they have withdrawals, they don't interact well with people, they have depression, which sometimes means they have substance abuse problems. You know, a Congress that couldn't get its budget in line for 7 years is telling those women, you've got to be in the workforce and get your budget in line in two. And you've got to do it without adequate child care, adequate health care, without transportation, without job training, much less jobs that pay a living wage. One of the women that I was arrested with, and this is why I say it gets me annoyed when people say that, you know, we're like in Clinton's pocket, because I was arrested at Congress and then we led a three-week hunger strike and vigil outside the White House just as he was going to the Chicago Convention to be renominated. I mean, it was not a small thing. The people that we know on the inside of the White House said they used to every morning at their staff meetings talk about what was going on outside. And so it seemed to me to be one of the most disastrous bills for women. And one of the women that I went to jail with had fallen into poverty. It was classic. She had left a battering relationship. She fell into poverty. Public assistance was her lifeline. She got back into the waged workforce. She worked two jobs, was not seeing her kids. Her daughter was basically raising her son. She felt really bad about all that. Now, meanwhile, nobody ever talks until you're a CEO with a corporation about balancing work and family. That doesn't apply to poor women. And what happened? She had a heart attack. And she didn't have any health benefits in her job. And she became homeless and lived for a year on the streets with her kids. And those are the ones, to me, that when I look at them giving eliminating the minimum corporate tax so that some of the actually most profitable before they cook their books corporations in this country pay nothing, and they're taking food literally out of the mouths of poor women and children, I opposed it very strongly.
Thank you. The NRA has long been one of the most effective lobbying organizations in America. How can these lessons be applied to now and other feminist organizations?
They can't, because the NRA is principally supported financially by gun manufacturers and sellers. I mean, they've got an industry behind them with an economic interest. It's like the United States Chamber of Commerce or the Manufacturers Association. This happens to be the gun market. And so they put forward as their public face people who do target practice, have, you know, sport hunting, little kids who've gone through their firearm safety program. But the reality is that they're gun dealers. I almost said drug dealers, because I'm thinking after the Colorado debacle and there was another high school shooting today, and Gore just broke the tie in the Senate to finally get background checks at these gun shows. I mean, that was the big loophole that you could drive your Mack truck through on your way to the gun show to pick up a bunch of guns without being background checked, and now they've closed that. I'm assuming the president's going to sign it. But we made a very conscious decision to be supported financially by our members. And so our budget comes overwhelmingly from individual donations from members and people who join. And the average gift is about $27. And that was a conscious decision to remain a movement, to have chapters at the grassroots level. We send over $1 million out to our chapters. Many other organizations, their chapters have to raise all their own money. You know, NARAL, bless their hearts, they do good work. They don't send a penny to the field. So it was a decision we made. It keeps us poor. You know, I'm so thrilled now that there are some feminists who've made money. And so I'm starting to rethink this position. But basically, I don't want to get tied up with any industry that's going to control our agenda. I want our membership to control our agenda.
Thank you. There's not surprisingly a number of questions that relate to Clinton. Are there feminist benefits that can actually be gained from the Clinton scandal?
I hope so. I think that we have had a limited success in drawing the distinction between consensual adult relations, a la Jennifer Flowers or, what's her name, Dolly Browning, versus workplace sexual relationships. And then within those workship relationships, we have to distinguish between consensual or welcome sexual advances, or in the case of Monica Lewinsky, by her own admission, actively sought after sexual advances, which are not illegal, versus stories that, if Paula Jones, what she said was true, if she could have proved it at trial, that is, to my mind, should be illegal harassment. But I think one of the things I'd like to do, which is what we did after Anita Hill's confrontation with the United States Senate, where they're going to, you know, we demonstrated to make them have a public hearing, not just to have the judiciary panel sweep her assertions under the rug so that we all could see and judge, that they couldn't any longer just decide this stuff behind closed doors. And after that, all these guys on in the Senate were going, oh, we care so much about equal employment opportunities. We are so concerned about sexual harassment. Now, put him on the court because she's a lying, hallucinating, you know, bad person, but boy, do we care about this. So we hoist them on their own petard and got a bill passed the 1991 Civil Rights Act that then, because of the political pressure Bush had to sign, he had vetoed the earlier bill, calling it a quota bill. Suddenly it was a Civil Rights Act, and he signed it, and we got for the first time a right to trial by jury in employment discrimination cases, and damages. We'd never been able to get damages. You could get back pay, but you couldn't get any kind of damages, for instance, if your health was impaired or if you lost your job. I mean, you could. It just was not an adequate law. It's still not adequate. We still have a 180-day statute of limitations. There is almost no other statute of limitations that is that short. 180 days is a very short. It's why Paula Jones had to go under the civil rights laws instead of the employment discrimination, because that 180-day window had closed. Plus, there's a cap on damages. No matter how much you can prove you were damaged financially, you can't get more than $300,000. And so I want to take all of our newfound friends in Congress, all of the Trent Lotts and Bob Barrs and all these guys who care so much about women in the workplace, who have just discovered that this problem is so serious, and see if we can't go back and amend, you know, and change those laws. Get some more funding for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, for the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs. I do think that we may be able to use this, and often we can use really bad things that happen in our culture to put a spotlight on it. I remember, as we all do, when Denise Brown and Ron Goldman were murdered, and the Violence Against Women Act had been languishing in Congress for years. And when that happened, there were now all of these demonstrations and all of this pressure brought on the Congress, and we got that bill, you know, pulled out of the Congress finally. And so sometimes out of tragedy, we're able to make people aware of what's going on and change the public policy. I'd love to be able to do that this time.
Kind of a fun one here. If you were Hillary Clinton, what would you do at the end of Bill's term? Both professionally and personally.
Oh, my. See, I'm not Hillary Clinton, and the whole point of this feminist movement, in my part of our biggest point, was that women should be more independent, that we should have more power and control, not over other people, but over our own lives and destinies. And I wouldn't second guess what goes on in another person's marriage. I don't know. I mean, I can speculate. I can try to imagine what I would do in that situation, but I don't think anybody can imagine what it must be like to be married to the President of the United States and to be in the White House and to have all of the policy implications that come from, you know, do you two hold hands? Do you look away from each other? You know, are they together? Are they going to, you know, I think it's a diversion from looking at some of the real issues that people speculate about Hillary and argue that she's standing by her man. In my opinion, because I looked at her, I ran into her several times campaigning in 1998, and she was out there so strong on the issues and so passionate about making social and political change, and I really had this strong feeling that she was not, that she is a strong woman, that she was not going to let herself be distracted and knocked askew by his stupidity. And I think she got a lot of points from people for carrying extraordinary pressure with great dignity. So I hope, the political part of me hopes that she will run for office. You know, maybe she could get on Gore's ticket, But on the other hand, maybe she should run in New York. I think as a person, if I were her friend, I would urge her not to run because it will be brutal. But as a political person, I would like to see her in office. I'd rather, you know, have had her in office in the first place.
A number of questions with regard to your opinions on various candidates. So maybe you could just run down a couple, like Al and Bill Bradley, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Elizabeth is not going to get out of the primaries. It's not going to happen. It's not a happening thing. The majority of the state party structures in the Republican Party are controlled by the religious political extremists. And it's just not going to happen. I think it would be very interesting. I always have thought that the Republicans would be the first ones to have a woman elected president. It's sort of like, you know, Nixon going to China. There's this notion, I think, of fear of women presidents because of this whole, you know, national defense thing. Would she be able to put her finger on the button and push it? You know, to launch the missiles. And it's why they got a Maggie Thatcher as the first woman prime minister. Not only could they envision her pushing the button, they could gleefully launching the missiles, you know. She's got one good leg up in the sense that there is a first spouse problem that has to be solved before women are going to be elected president. What happened to Bill Clinton happened in largest part, I mean, by his own stupidity, but the hook that the special prosecutor was able to get hooked onto for 4 years and, what, about $100 million at this point, was that she had had a full-time, serious career in the business world as a lawyer. And it was the same thing with John Zaccaro, who was always used against Jerry Ferraro. And it was rumored when Pat Schroeder made her brief run for the Democratic nomination and then withdrew amid great tears that her husband's law firm represented some foreign interests that the voters would have found very unsavory. And so, you know, Elizabeth Dole's husband has been vetted within an inch of his life. We all know perhaps more than we ever wanted to know now that he's doing commercials. But, you know, that's... So it's a little early to have much about Al Gore and Bill Bradley. I think Bill Bradley has some very good ideas. I've been very interested in his, neither one of them can campaign their way out of a paper bag. I'm being honest here. This is going to be broadcast. This could be bad. They're both very fine men on the issues, and I'm sure they're going to have some great campaign staff that are going to make sure that they have a terrific... I heard that Al's stump speech in Iowa has really gotten to be good now. But I think that the big issue is going to be George W. And he has taken a kinder, gentler... rhetorical stand, but his stands on the issues are not a whole lot different than his father's.
Most unfortunately, we have a number of unasked and unanswered questions, but we have reached the point in our program where it's time for just one last question, so let me see if I can fold in a couple. And that's in the area of advice. What would you say to young people, particularly young women, to encourage them not to stand aside of the feminist movement and to postpone their sexual activity?
It's not fun. It's no good. Don't do it. But that would be wrong. It's one of the discussions we had when the Monica Lewinsky story broke. We have interns in our office, and in the summer we have, you know, maybe 20 interns. And it's my habit when we have something like that break to get everybody in the office together, including the interns, and brainstorm, you know, what do you think? What are the implications politically? What should we do? What should we say? And the interns were so very clear that we could not say a 23-year-old woman cannot decide who she's going to have sex with. And, you know, as a 53-year-old woman, I might have had a different view of that because I've lived through a lot. And, you know, I think that it's sort of hopeless, though. I mean, we've had young feminist summits, and I love the enthusiasm, the energy, the creativity, the commitment. Younger and younger, we've got middle school girls, even I have to call them girls at that age, who are taking part in now conferences. And when we did our vision statement, and we had a line in there that said, we envision a world where women are heard, valued, and respected, an 11-year-old and a 12-year-old who were delegates from South Carolina and New Jersey got up and made an amendment. One of them made it, the other one seconded it, and it passed to amend it to say, we envision a world where women and girls are heard, valued, and respected. So I love the young feminists, and they're getting younger and younger, and like every generation, they are the first generation that ever discovered sex. They're the first ones who ever liked it anyway. And, you know, it really makes me feel old, okay? I'm very pleased with all of the discussion about geriatric sex. I have a friend who is the deputy dean of a medical school, and they run a course for the community for the retired community called Sex Now That You Have Time For It, which I thought was rather good, none of which is going to discourage the young people. But I think part of it is changing the culture so that more young women and girls value themselves for other things than their sexual attractiveness. I mean, I think the culture still does value women in some ways by how we look. Are we conventionally attractive, and are we sexually available to men? I mean, do we meet that expectation that's there? And so I think when I look at Monica Lewinsky, for instance, I worry about what will happen to her because she seems to place so much of her self-value on her appearance. Are my hips too big? You know, is my... And I can tell you that even if you are perfect and gorgeous in your 20s, this is also a very ageist culture. And you will not be conventionally attractive for long. I happen to think that we are all wonderfully attractive. I wear my face because I earned it. I wouldn't dream of cutting it up, you know, although some mornings I get up and go, oh, just a little lift here. And I realize that there is an outpost of the patriarchy in my brain. But, you know, I think that in terms of advice for young people, especially young women, the most important thing that I think all of us need to realize of any age is that we have a lot more power than we think. And we so often just decide that there's nothing we can do about it. It's too big. These problems are overwhelming. You know, there's Kosovo and there's the Sudan and there's, you know, they're launching missiles over Japan from China and, you know, and it's the Congress and it's the court and it's, you know, all of this stuff going on. But all of us have the power to make change. When I was a stewardess, for goodness sake, and it was the lowest job on the totem pole, I was able to make that company change their employment practices and policies for all the women that were in the company. I was like, wow, that feels good. I want to do that again. But, you know, that was like perceived to be and actually a very powerless position. But because I was willing to step out of my zone of comfort, to speak up, to say this is not right, and because there was a movement to back me up, because I knew the National Organization for Women had just been formed, because I'd seen pictures in the newspaper of them occupying the offices of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which had no intention initially of enforcing Title VII on behalf of women. And so I knew they were there. There was a movement. There was me with a little bit of courage. They gave me information. They didn't do for me. They just told me how to do for myself. And I affected a corporation, a huge, you know, multinational corporation. Now, mind you, they went bankrupt afterwards, and I became the president of now, but I swear. So, you know, I would urge on both questions, you know, the advice and on postponing sexuality or sex, that life is pretty long, and it's hard to imagine in your youth the consequences that come from decisions that you make. I think of Monica in that sense. And the satisfying life, the life that makes you feel good about yourself and not just that you're some blob of protoplasm that was born and died, to me comes from developing your sense of yourself, your self-worth, and your sure knowledge that you have a lot to give and that you have not just a right but an obligation to help move us forward. There's still a lot wrong in this world, but we are way ahead of where we were But it could be, you know, it's also not, the progress is also not irreversible. And so that, I want to see people get active, unless they disagree with me, at which point they should be apathetic.
Our thanks to Patricia Ireland, president of the National Organization for Women, for joining us tonight. Thanks also to those of you here at Hyatt Ricky's Palo Alto, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Silicon Valley Forum of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.